North by the Shondas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We turn now to Gaza, where human rights experts say a deliberate man-made famine is underway. Last month, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food accused Israel of carrying out a starvation campaign in Gaza. A new documentary by Al Jazeera English's Fault Lines worked with Palestinian reporters to investigate how Israel has killed civilians seeking aid and attacked humanitarian networks in Gaza, and that the U.S. knows this is happening and has done nothing to stop it. In a minute, we'll be joined by the filmmaker. We begin with a clip from Starving Gaza and a warning. This contains graphic images and descriptions. In this clip, we hear from a Palestinian doctor, Ahmed Nasser, who's trying to save severely malnourished children in Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza.
I don't think anyone in North Gaza has enough food to eat. We have a new malnutrition case. The number of cases is beyond the malnutrition clinic's capacity.
Every day, the cries of hungry children fill the halls of Kamal Adwan Hospital in North Gaza. Some children here at the malnutrition clinic have never known a full meal in their lives. After the Hamas attacks on October 7th, Israel cut off fuel, food, and water from Gaza. Within weeks, starvation had spread in the north. Israel doesn't allow foreign journalists into Gaza, so we worked with Palestinian reporters who filmed for us at Kamal Adwan Hospital in June.
How often does he have fever?
He had a high fever and diarrhea all night.
Abdulaziz is 5 months old and starving. Dr. Ahmed Nasser has been taking care of him with what little resources the hospital has on hand.
Should I be concerned? He had a fever for 20 days before I brought him to the hospital.
The situation is very serious. The child cannot absorb anything in his body. Anything that enters his body is excreted without benefit to him. His mother brought him to the hospital because the child was suffering from chronic diarrhea, vomiting, and high body temperature. Many times we were shocked to see 30 to 40 cases in one day for the same reason.
That's part of the opening to the new Fault Lines documentary, Starving Gaza. And this is another clip we hear from the parents of two-year-old Khaled, who died of malnutrition in February, an otherwise healthy toddler before Israel began its Gaza assault.
It's very difficult to lose your child because he was hungry. It's hard.
When famine starts, it takes the youngest first. It's been 5 months since Hanan Asaf and her husband Mohammed buried their two-year-old son, Khaled. This is Khaled in happier times, before the war on Gaza and the starvation that followed.
This war destroyed everything. Houses, people, trees, stones, everything was destroyed. This was my youngest son's room. The occupation forces burned it. They didn't leave us a single memory, nothing. The boy was fine. All of a sudden, he started to cry all the time. He began eating less because there was no food. He was used to drinking milk and eating rice and fruits. But since the beginning of the war, it decreased until it completely ran out. There was nothing available at all except for wild greens. And the prices are unbelievable for whatever is there. The boy looked like a skeleton. He was gone. He was completely gone. I would hold him like a newborn. He stopped being able to sit up, move, or walk. His body became very weak. I took him to Kamal Adwan Hospital. There was no medicine or treatment. On the last 2 days, he was on a ventilator.
Khaled died of severe dehydration and malnutrition at Kamal Adwan Hospital on February 2nd, 2024.
Starving Gaza. For more, we're joined in London by Hind Hassan, journalist, filmmaker, long covered Palestine and directed Starving Gaza for Fault Lines on Al Jazeera English. Welcome, Hind, to Democracy Now! This is a horrifying documentary. If you can start off by talking about these devastating effects of this last year on Gaza, and then we'll talk about the expose of the U.S. suppressing its own reports on preventing humanitarian aid from getting in, Israel doing that.
Thank you. And before I start doing that, first of all, thank you so much for having me on the show. But I just want to say that I am a documentary filmmaker. I'm a journalist. But this documentary was made by many people. The director, you know, was Mark, who works at Fault Lines at Al Jazeera, and all the other filmmakers that we had in Gaza. And their role is so central. And I think that's what makes this documentary so unique, is that collaboration that we had with the filmmakers who were inside Gaza so that they can showcase to the world the realities of what is happening in Gaza at the moment, and also show just how skilled they are and the conditions that they are working in, and yet they are still producing these incredibly powerful documentaries and films. But to your question, since October the 7th, we have seen the siege that already existed on Gaza increase. And as part of that, there has been a significant decrease in the amount of aid that has been able to get into Gaza. And as a result of that, we have seen a lot of children and women who are pregnant and newborns, toddlers and people suffering from malnutrition because they haven't been able to get access to the necessary food or the aid that is needed for them to be able to live a healthy life. And as a result of that, we have seen numerous cases of children who have died as a result of malnutrition. But the number of deaths just touches the reality on the ground and the number of people who are being impacted by what's happening. And this documentary, what it does is it speaks to the victims on the ground. It talks to those individuals who've lost their children, who have had to struggle with not being able to provide milk or formula or food, or have not been able, pregnant women who are not being able to provide the sustenance that babies need, doctors who are in the wards and who are trying to deal with the high number of victims that are coming in, with the patients that are coming in, showing you that day to day of what happens. And then also the search for accountability that you mentioned outside of Gaza, in the United States and in the United Kingdom. Because, of course, we as international journalists have not been able to get into Gaza since October the 7th. We have had to rely completely on our colleagues who are inside Gaza, who are not only working every single day, who don't have a break, who can't take a moment to try and gather themselves, but who have also been displaced, who have lost family members, who have been through incredible trauma of their own, but yet they are still documenting other people's trauma in order for us to understand the realities of what's happening on the ground. Because we haven't been able to go in and support our colleagues, we did what we could outside in order to support and showcase their work inside of Gaza.
And Hind, could you explain, I mean, you've said a little bit about this, how is it that you contacted people in Gaza, since, as you mentioned, Al Jazeera has not been there? Who were the filmmakers that you worked with?
So actually, I want to tell you a story about one of the filmmakers. We had many people who worked on the ground with us. We coordinated with people who were outside Gaza. It's a full Palestinian team. So there are people who are outside who help us coordinate inside. And then we also worked alongside cameramen, cinematographers and directors of photography who were inside Gaza. It's incredibly difficult. It's not easy to do because they are constantly dealing with a lack of data, lack of ability to be able to send footage over. The internet is very patchy and is very difficult. So communication is tough for us to be able to get in to communicate with them, let alone send that high quality footage over to us. And on top of that, they're dealing with daily bombardments and they're dealing with their own issues. But there is our director of photography who is inside Gaza. His name is Hussein Jaber. When I learnt about his story, I was completely shocked. And there's not much that shocks us journalists that work on these stories, because we see so many horrors and we hear the stories of people and what they've been through. But when I heard about our own colleague and what had happened to him, I was really blown away. It's a heartbreaking story. So on the 5th of December, Hossein Jaber had gone to Gaza City, where his family were. They had been ordered to evacuate by Israel, and so they were trying to head west, which is what they had been ordered to do. And he had been working. He'd gone to Gaza City in order to help his children evacuate. They had been staying in a building for a number of days, and then he sees his daughter running towards him, his youngest daughter, who's just 4 years old. Her name is Sanma, and as she's running to him, he describes the Israeli military firing bullets. It's sprayed everywhere. And he sees, as his daughter runs towards him, he sees his daughter shot in the neck. She's then still running somehow, slowly. She's writhing in pain. He runs towards her and he embraces her, and she dies. And this was our director of photography. This was not someone we featured in the documentary. This was the man who was filming that trauma. He watched his four-year-old die and be killed in the neck, just shot in the neck and killed just in December. Somehow his nine-year-old daughter, Sarah, survived. She had a bullet that went through her jacket, but she managed to survive. And then his son, Amr, his three-year-old son, he says, is still asking, where is Sanma? Where is my sister? And also, during that, as his daughter was shot, he was also hit. He doesn't remember how it happened, when it happened, because it was all a blur and he was focused on his daughter. But he was also shot, and Al Jazeera did an interview with him, and there's a photograph of him on the Al Jazeera website where his arm is in a sling and he has external screws on his arm. This is the story of the Palestinian journalists in Gaza. So many of them have gone through this. They've been displaced, they've been injured, they've watched their own children die in front of them, and yet they somehow conjure the professionalism to pick up a camera and record and tell other people's trauma. And I think that's what is so powerful about this documentary. What's so unique about it is the way that we've tried to collaborate. This is a platform for them to tell their story. This is a platform for them to show the world what is happening to the children of Gaza, the impact of the lack of aid and the lack of food being able to get in. And it really is them center stage. And our role is to support them, is to be able to do that chasing and to do the accountability chasing. There is a moment in the film where I actually speak to Dr. Ahmed Nasser. And even during that, you don't see it on the documentary. You just see the moments that we managed to speak to him. But just during that communication, the line cut off maybe 5 or 6 times, and we had to keep calling back, and we had to keep waiting. And the journalists who were filming on the other side, so Hossein Jaber and his colleagues, they were so patient, they were so professional. And I think as we look back on these moments and these times, and remember the journalists in Gaza, they really will be remembered in history as the titans of as journalists. And it's a complete honor for every single one of us that worked on this documentary to be able to say that we worked alongside them.
And let's remember that so many have died, have been killed in the Israeli assault. Over the estimates are 170 journalists. Now, I want to go to, it's the film is sort of in two parts, and then it's responsibility for what's happening in Gaza. This is a clip from Starving Gaza that features Stacey Gilbert. She's former senior advisor in the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees and Migration, resigned after over 20 years, after disagreements with how the State Department put out the report that she worked on, that concluded that Israel was not obstructing U.S. humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Not her conclusion.
It is widely known and documented in the humanitarian community and the U.S. government that Israel has been blocking humanitarian assistance since the start of the Gaza conflict.
Stacey Gilbert was a senior officer in the U.S. State Department and specialized in humanitarian assistance. She resigned in May after the Biden administration concluded Israel isn't blocking aid.
They have made a policy decision to support Israel unconditionally.
What are those specific ways of
aid being blocked?
It's everything. There are administrative obstacles, not enough customs officials checking these items. The food that goes bad because it's waiting on the trucks. So it's like a spigot. They turn on, they turn off. They decide that some things can't go in, other things can. Aid workers' visas are denied or delayed. And when the pressure builds, they will allow more assistance in. But then the spigot gets turned off again. So Israel and the United States government will say, look, some assistance is going in. It's never been enough. And they know that.
The U.S. gives Israel billions of dollars in security funding each year. There's a U.S. law that prohibits arms transfers to countries that are blocking humanitarian assistance.
The administration deliberately denies the facts on the ground because it would trigger consequences to cut off security funding. It allows the weapons sales to continue. The weapons are the engine that fuel this war, and we are not taking responsibility for our role in it.
So that was Stacey Gilbert, former senior advisor in the State Department, who resigned. Hind Hassan, this is another clip from your report, Starving Gaza. When you come to Washington and question State Department spokesperson Matt Miller.
We went to a press briefing at the U.S. State Department to ask about Washington's support for Israel as famine has spread throughout Gaza. We've had aid organizations and relief groups who've said over and over again that Israel is using starvation as a tactic of war. How do you respond to the allegations of complicity of the U.S. government? And what more will it take for the U.S. to stop Israeli military funding?
So is the United States that has secured all of the major agreements to get more humanitarian assistance into Gaza. Going back to the very early days, the first week after October 7th, when the secretary traveled to the region and the president traveled to Israel, and together convinced Israel to open Rafah crossing to allow humanitarian assistance in. It has not been enough. There are obstacles. Sometimes those are logistical obstacles coming from Israel. Sometimes those are the nature of moving humanitarian assistance around in an armed conflict.
Under U.S. law, it is required that any country receiving military support must not obstruct the flow of humanitarian aid during war. And every major rights group, from the United Nations to Human Rights Watch, has said that Israel is using starvation as a tactic of war. Do you disagree with them? And are you just, sorry, one final question. Are you not afraid of completely losing legitimacy, of being seen as being hypocritical when it comes to supporting human rights in one country, but not when it comes to Palestinians?
Let me just answer the first question. So I would encourage you to read the report that we issued on this very question 2 months ago that looked into Israel's compliance with international humanitarian law and their work and whether they had done a good enough job to let humanitarian assistance in, where we said that there were some roadblocks that needed to be overcome, and we had worked to overcome those, and we had seen Israel take steps to allow humanitarian assistance in.
So that's State Department spokesperson Matt Miller, and Hassan questioning him in Washington, D.C. Coming out of the Stacey Gilbert clip from the film, who quit the State Department over the report that was issued, and ProPublica recently revealed that USAID and the State Department's Refugees Bureau, where she worked, both concluded this spring that Israel had deliberately blocked deliveries of food and medicine into Gaza, but U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other top Biden officials rejected the findings of the agencies. Blinken's decision allowed the U.S. to keep sending arms to Israel. Your final thoughts, Hind?
So, as you saw there, two very contrasting statements. You have the former State Department official saying that Israel is deliberately blocking aid. And then you have Matt Miller saying, oh, please check out our report. Israel could do more, but they're not deliberately blocking aid. And to understand this, you really have to understand Stacey Gilbert and her role and who she is. She has worked for the State Department for many, many years. She's been doing this job for decades. And this decision may have been an easy decision for her, but it's not one that she took lightly. She's worked in so many other countries. So for her, at this point, to decide, I cannot continue in my job, I must step down
because of this shows you how huge that is, that opinion is to her, or what's happened, it is to her. And so I really don't think that you can take lightly what she's done or any of the other officials who have resigned. I was born in Iraq and I remember watching all the resignations of the officials in the United States who did not support the war in Iraq or the invasion for legality reasons. And so it's full circle now to have been sat in front of Stacey Gilbert and to hear her say that she is haunted by that report, and that the reason why she resigned was because she wants to be an asterisk in the history books, that she didn't stay quiet and that she spoke up. And so I think viewers can watch this documentary and they can make up their own minds, but there is a huge body of evidence which suggests that Israel has been purposefully blocking the flow of aid into Gaza, and that the United States government knows about it.
Hind Hassan, we thank you so much for being with us. Journalist, documentary filmmaker, has long covered Palestine, is the correspondent and narrator on the new Al Jazeera documentary film, Starving Gaza, worked with many Palestinian filmmakers in Gaza. Coming up, the death toll from Hurricane Helene nears 200 as we look at six plastic factory workers feared dead after floodwaters swelled around their Tennessee workplace. Their boss repeatedly threatened to fire anyone who left during the storm back in 20 seconds.
Shadows are falling and I'm running out of breath. Me in your heart for a while. If I leave you, it doesn't mean I love you any less. Keep me in your heart for a while. When you get up in the morning and you see that crazy sun, keep me in your heart for a while. There's a train leaving nightly called when all is said and done. Keep me in your heart for a while.
Keep me in your heart by Warren Zevon. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We look now at the impact of Hurricane Helene. Power outages and water shortages continue across six southeastern states. The death toll from the storm is nearing 200, with hundreds more still missing and presumed dead. This includes six plastic factory workers in Irwin, Tennessee, who were swept away as floodwaters swelled around their workplace after their boss reportedly threatened to fire anyone who left during the storm. This is the family of an impact plastics worker named Lydia Verdugo.
She was still working when she called me, and she told me that it was really raining, and I told her to leave, but she told me they weren't telling her anything.
If they would have told them to leave earlier, maybe we would be here. They would still be here today, and we wouldn't be looking for them. But when they tried to leave, it was too late.
The Tennessee Bureau of Investigations investigating how some workers said impact plastics threatened to fire anyone who left ahead of the storm. This is Robert Jarvis, one of the survivors.
What would you say to the company?
Why'd you make us work that day? Why? We shouldn't have worked. We shouldn't have been there. None of us should have been there. And that's what I should have said to them.
Impact Plastics said Monday in a statement it had monitored weather conditions during the storm and that managers had dismissed workers, quote, when water began to cover the parking lot and the adjacent service road and the plant lost power, unquote. For more, we're joined by Cesar Bautista, campaign director at the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition, has been working in Irwin, Tennessee to assist with relief efforts after Hurricane Helene. Cesar, welcome to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes. Can you explain what happened? This plastics factory is right next to a river. What were they told? Why were they so afraid they'd be fired if they didn't come to work?
Yes. Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, so a lot of the family members, you know, expressed just like on the clip that you showed, that they were told like not to leave yet. They were still asking questions, like, you know, should we leave or not, so forth. They kept going back and forth, I believe, with one of the secretaries at the office. But as they were trying to get answers, they were noticing that the water was getting higher and higher, like in the parking lot area. And, you know, once like the factory did make the decision of telling people, OK, you can go, it was just too late. And the water had risen too high to the point that they couldn't move their cars anymore and try to get to safety.
And so what are you calling for, Cesar? You're obviously advocating on the rights of these workers. What are you calling for?
Well, you know, in these moments right now, it's very difficult, you know, and we are standing in solidarity with all the families that they lost a loved one. Most importantly, what we're calling is just to be sure that there's equitable access to the recovery plan that the city and the state have initiated. So just making sure, you know, that there's no language barriers, that everybody has the equal amount of access, you know, to any kind of resources that are being provided, just to be sure that the families, you know, have what they need to, in order to rebuild their lives after this hurricane.
So talk about how typical this was. Now, again, to emphasize, Impact Plastics said at no time were employees told they would be fired if they left the facility. But if you can overall talk about the fear of migrant workers, and also we're talking about a vast area of six states right now. You work with the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition. We don't really know how many people have died, not close to 200 at this point, quantified, but hundreds more missing. And where are people going for refuge?
You know, so here in Erwin, Tennessee, a lot of people right now have been going to the county high school for any kind of refuge or resources that they're looking for. That has been a great source. Also, the local church, one of the local churches, St. Michael, has been, you know, just a great supporter for the community to gather, to mourn, to, you know, just really process everything that has been happening. And so that has been, you know, what where people have been going mainly, you know, just to try to find some comfort and support with the community. I would say too, you know, that the community overall has shown they've come up as a unified form, you know, just like to really support each other and, you know, just to keep each other together throughout this, you know, tough process right now.
And the understanding about climate change for many immigrants, one of the reasons they came to this country, fleeing the devastation of climate change in their country, and then dealing with it today here. All the reports are saying the intensification, the rapidity with which this storm intensified due to climate change.
Right. And so, you know, with climate change, as we see this, you know, this is starting to be more of a pattern now. Here in Tennessee, you know, we had the hurricane, you know, just a couple of days ago. Last December, we had a tornado go through Nashville, Tennessee. And then 2 years before that, there was another tornado. And so we've noticed that, you know, this is starting to become a pattern. And so what really we're urging, you know, our municipalities and like in the state, you know, not just in Tennessee, but across the country, is that they have to have like, you know, those evacuation plans, you know, for like, you know, for each city, but also now, you know, for each company that, you know, has like, you know, like all these workers there, in order to be sure that people are safe, but also to set up an infrastructure where everybody has equitable access. Where everybody has equitable access, you know, for
Cesar
the recovery.
Bautista, we're going to have to leave it there. Campaign director at the Tennessee Immigrant and Refugee Rights Coalition in Erwin, Tennessee. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free. It's free. It's free. It's online and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at riverstosuccess.ca. Again, that's riverstosuccess.ca.